From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, we're revisiting some of our favorite recent conversations. Later, we'll hear from Chicago historian Sherman Thomas, who goes by Dilla, and has become famous on the social media platform TikTok. But first, Art Spiegelman's graphic novel of the Holocaust, called Mouse, is among a number of books being banned or challenged around the country. We spoke with a panel of Illinois educators and writers about the value of introducing young minds to difficult subjects. This conversation was first broadcast back in February. Around the country, at school board meetings, in state legislatures, and in some local libraries, books are facing challenges. And many of the books being challenged have to do with race.
A school board is about to get hit with a lawsuit after banning a book written by a Nobel Prize winner. The Wentzville District made the decision to remove Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye last month.
A controversial book taken out of Rova schools will remain out of the classrooms. The board decided the book, The Hate U Give, should not be part of any lesson plan until it's fully reviewed by the community and the schools.
Other books are generating attention from some parents because of sexual themes, but those books also happen to be by LGBTQ authors. Here's a clip from a school board meeting in Downers Grove, Illinois, back in November, when a parent requested that the book Gender Queer, a Memoir by Maya Kobabe, be banned.
Hank, you and your friends are trying to convince us that Genderqueer, a child pornographic sketchbook, is acceptable in our schools under the pretense of inclusion and comedy. Additionally, you say it's okay because it's not assigned reading. It's only in the library. None of this justifies offering our children pornography. What you're doing to our children in the name of politics is criminal. Instead of wasting our time, our money, indoctrinating our children with CRT, equity, and disgusting pornographic material, you should focus our tax dollars on our children's education. Teach them reading, writing, and arithmetic.
All right. Here to talk more about the rise in book censorship, or at least book removal from curriculumship, what's behind it and how it affects which lived experiences get shared in classrooms, we're joined now by Emily Knox. She's an assistant professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She's also the author of the book, Book Banning in 21st Century America. Professor Knox, Emily, thank you so much for being back with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
I'd also like to welcome Kelly Jensen. She's a Chicago-based editor of Book Riot. She's been tracking the latest challenges to books around the country through a weekly digest. Kelly, welcome to the 21st to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Brett Kaplan. She's a professor of comparative literature and Jewish studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and is director of the Initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies there. She recently wrote an opinion piece titled Why I'm Adding Mouse to My Fall Syllabus after a school board in Tennessee banned the book recently. Brett, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So, Brett, I want to begin with you. For people who aren't familiar with Mouse, M-A-U-S, can you briefly describe the book or books?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing to know about Mouse is that it's a really complex book. So sometimes I think it's a little bit confusing for people who see it for the first time. I wish I could show you the visual. Here it is for the people who could see. It's a graphic memoir, and it tells the story of Art Spiegelman, the author, and his relationship with his father, which is really, really complicated. And from the very first page, we see those complexities. So his father is a Holocaust survivor. And on the very first page, Art comes in, he's been attacked by some kids, he's sad, he's crying, he wants some empathy and support from his father. And what does his father say? Ugh, you think that's difficult? Lock them in a room, don't feed them, then they'll know what difficulty is. So from the very beginning, we see that the trauma that the father suffered is really impeding the father's ability to empathize and nurture his son. And this is a very complex story as it moves through that has lots and lots and lots of different layers. And that is actually why I think it's so important.
Yeah, and you mentioned the book's cover. For people who can't see it, which is pretty much all of our listeners, it has a drawing of a mouse sort of superimposed, at least the version I'm looking at, over a swastika. So there's definitely Nazi imagery. It deals a lot with the Holocaust. Were you planning to teach Mouse in the fall before you found out about the decision of that school board in Tennessee?
No, actually, I wasn't. And I'm so glad you said that. I'm teaching in the fall a class called Jewish American and U.S. Minority Literatures in Dialogue, which fulfills the U.S. Minority Cultures requirement at UIUC. And I've taught this class a few times with different books. I was not planning to teach Maus because it's not a Holocaust class. But as soon as, thank you, McMinn County, as soon as they made their announcement, I decided that I would add it to the syllabus. And I've decided that I'll pair it with another graphic novel, which I haven't yet read, although I've read the original novel, which is Octavia Butler's Kindred. And I think in a sense, Maus is important because of the story that it tells, but it's also really important because of the ways in which it opened pathways for other graphic novels and other graphic memoirs to tell all kinds of different stories, including, you mentioned at the opening segment, LGBTQ stories. So another very important graphic novel is Fun Home, which tells the story of her, of Alison Bechtel's, also difficulties with her family and all of the sort of secrets and lies that are underneath the layering that she's been granted. So no, I wasn't planning to teach Maus in the fall, but now I am because they've reminded me what an important book it is and how important it is to share this story with students and to get them to learn something about Holocaust history, but also about difficult family relations and how, in a sense, it's validating to see another character have these difficult family relations. Because, like, let's face it, who's got an easy family relationship, right?
Yeah, and I want to put a pause on some of the value that these books can bring in experiencing other people's perspectives and come back to that a little later in the conversation. Kelly Jensen, let me bring you in now, editor at Book Riot. You've been tracking this recent wave of book censorship. Do you know, has Maus been banned or challenged anywhere else?
In this current wave, I don't believe so, but there was a wave of censorship probably about 10 years ago now. I would have to look back for an exact date, but graphic novels were the big source of those challenges at that time, and Maus was very, very common to show up then. We still see it regularly, but not necessarily like we're seeing type... Well, that's embarrassing.
What? Oh. You were just saying that you were seeing it. You know, there was a wave of graphic novels being banned about 10 years ago, but yeah. It's not necessarily what's happening now. What is happening now? What are some of the books that have been coming under fire recently?
Some of the most common ones are genderqueer, which you mentioned at the top of the segment. We have The Hate U Give has shown up quite a bit. Dear Martin by Nick Stone has shown up often, as has All Boys Aren't Blue by George Johnson. These books are, I don't want to say different than Maus, but they're more contemporary than Maus. And I think that that is where we're seeing more of the challenges. They're more modern books that have come out in the last 5, 6, 7 years, where Maus is a little bit more of a classic at this point.
Yeah. And not about necessarily things that happened 80 years ago, but about things that are happening now or could be happening now in fiction. Yeah. Let me bring Emily Knox into the conversation now. Is it appropriate to use the word banned books in these cases, right? I mean, if a book can't be taught in a classroom, maybe it can still be gotten from a library or the next district over. Is there an important distinction to be made there?
So my editor insisted that I call my book banning in 21st century America because that's catchy, but you'll see in the first chapter that I actually say something like, I talk about book challenges rather than book bans. So what I teach are the four R's of censorship practices, as I call them. So those are redaction, restriction, relocation, and removal. Removal is really what we're talking about with banning, but I also do some research and look at how people define what censorship is, and people have both narrow and broad definitions. Interestingly enough, Maus was actually redacted first, so they actually marked through the bad words first before it was removed. So you actually see several different censorship practices in this particular case.
I was going to jump in as soon
Please.
As you mentioned, this is Kelly. I I really appreciate that you make that distinction, because I think a lot of what we're seeing in the media is the use of the word ban, but not an actual look at what's really happening. With Mouse, it was very complex. The text started with redactions, and then they decided that that wasn't enough. They were going to pull it from curriculum. The book is still available in the high school, in the library. It's just not the curriculum now. And so by conflating ban with what happened, I think that it removes just how slippery a slope censorship really is.
Yeah, and I want to say, I actually spent a little bit of time, I followed down the rabbit hole, so to speak, of trying to figure out exactly what happened at this board meeting. There's no audio or video that I could find, but I did find posted online the purported minutes of this meeting. And I want to read a little bit from the minutes of the school board meeting in Tennessee, where they, again, they voted to take Mouse off the curriculum. And as you've been saying, there was a discussion about striking out certain words. You know, how does that affect copyright? What does the author think? But the part I want to read are comments attributed to somebody named Mike Cochran. And again, I want to emphasize these are minutes, not a transcript, so I think we should consider this a paraphrase. But he says, "This idea that we have to have this kind of material in the class in order to teach history, I don't buy it. Not saying there's not important material. I've read it. I read through all of it and the parts it talks about his father. The father's a guy that went through the Holocaust. I really enjoyed. I liked it. There were other parts that were completely unnecessary. We're talking about teaching ethics to our kids, and it starts out with the dad and the son talking about when the dad lost his virginity. It wasn't explicit, but it was in there. You see the naked pictures. You see the razor, the blade where the mom is cutting herself. You see her lying in a pool of her own blood. You have all this stuff in here. Again, reading this to myself, it was a decent book until the end. I thought the end was stupid, to be honest with you." And again, this is paraphrasing a school board member in Tennessee. He goes on to say, "We don't need this stuff to teach kids history. We can teach them history. We can teach them graphic history. We can tell them exactly what happened, but we don't need all the nakedness and all the other stuff. It's not like this is the only book that comes up." So, Brett, I wanted to ask you to respond to that.
Yeah. Wow. So two things. First of all, I don't know if anyone heard Arch Beagleman himself responding. It was all over, you know, on CNN and so on and so forth. And he said, look, if you're going to look for nudity and you're going to be upset about a cartoon of a naked mouse, like, you know, your kids can go online and they can see nudity all they want. That's not really the place to be concerned about what your kids are seeing. So I would say, first of all, that that's masking the larger problem. And the larger problem is this anti-intellectualism, anti-complexity. And really, I mean, I just want to be very clear before I say what I'm about to say, which is that I am not equating, I repeat, I am not equating the contemporary US with Nazi Germany. But what I will say is that there is a similarity in anti-intellectualism and anti-complexity in both cases. So the myths of having, you know, what you just said of like, let's have history that's like happy history. Our country is founded on genocide. It's slavery and genocide and abusive practices are part of our history. And if we're just going to say, oh, it's just a happy history, that's actually not truthful. And that doesn't really serve us. And that doesn't help us to actually grapple with the reality that we live every day. And so in Nazi Germany, the kinds of books that were banned, the kinds of books that were burned, the kind of art that was denigrated, all shared one thing in common. They were all complex stories, complex narrative, things that could not be reduced to tiny little bite-sized propagandistic pieces. So like, for example, Make America Great Again, that's a myth, right? That's drawing on the exact same kinds of mythologizing that allowed the Nazi genocide to happen. And the reason why Spiegelman drew the characters in his graphic memoir as mice is because he's looking at the way Nazi propaganda worked, right? He's looking at how, for the consciousness of Holocaust survivors, they were treated as vermin, as mice, as something to be exterminated, and they internalized that. And so it's a very powerful combination of images and remembrance and story that got to that point. So I would say that the way that the Tennessee County Board is trying to couch it is in terms of these questions of, you know, nudity and inappropriateness, but really the real issue is that Mouse and Beloved and The Bluest Eye and other brilliant and complex texts really force us to grapple with complexities that go against the kinds of myths that sustain white supremacy.
Okay, we need to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation with Emily Knox from the U of I Urbana, the author of Book Banning in 21st Century America, Kelly Jensen, who tracks the latest challenges to books around the country, also an editor at Book Riot, and Brett Kaplan, another U of I professor who's also director of the initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies there. We're going to continue this conversation after a break. Also want to urge you to visit our website, 21stshow.org. There you can visit all of our past recent conversations and find a link to subscribe to our podcast. You can also find us in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One, anywhere you get your podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher. Just search for The 21st, The21ST. All right, more to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st Show. Do stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're revisiting our recent conversation on book banning, or book challenges is the better term, as we heard. There seems to be a wave of this in schools and libraries around the country, including right here in Illinois. We spoke with Emily Knox, associate professor in the School of Information Sciences at the U of I Urbana-Champaign, also the author of Book Banning in 21st Century America. Kelly Jensen's a Chicago-based editor of Book Riot. She's also been tracking the latest challenges to books around the country through a weekly digest. Lastly, Brett Kaplan is professor of comparative literature and Jewish studies at the U of I Urbana, also director of the Initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies. Before the break, we heard Brett talking about sort of a common theme here of anti-intellectualism and anti-complexity, really, is what she thinks some people are objecting to. Do you see that, and are there other threads you see in the this recent wave of challenges to books?
So I really love the excerpt that you read from the McGinn School Board, because what I call this is difficult knowledge that might seem obvious, but the way that the school board member put everything together into one. So losing your virginity, the Holocaust, suicide, just everything, all of these things about actually being human were just kind of all put together. Difficult knowledge is always hard to teach to children, because partially what we say is that minors should not be exposed to difficult knowledge. And especially in this country, we tend to believe that it should be only taught to them by their parents. Now, in order to be a citizen in our modern nation states, you have to be educated outside of just, you know, necessarily what your parents think. And we've developed a school system to educate people. And we've decided that, in fact, some of this knowledge has been pulled from private to more public knowledge, even though it is difficult. So that's really what I think about a lot. What we are grappling with now is, how do we talk about our history? The history of the world, the history of our country. I really think that a lot of this is related to the so-called Browning of America, the fact that we're going to be a majority-minority country. How do we tell our history outside of basically white Anglo-Saxon Protestant history, with what I say is a little detour to Ellis Island on the way, right? That's really how we've been taught our history for a very long time. And that is not adequate for where we are as a country right now. And this is going to be an ongoing fight. The 1619 Project just came out in a book form. We'll see how that shows up when it gets to libraries and curriculum. It's not going to be pretty. And also, there aren't any written histories of the insurrection of January 6th yet. I have no idea how, if I was a seventh grade social studies teacher in West Virginia, how I would teach the insurrection. We will see how that goes also.
Yeah, that's going to be fascinating to watch. Well, you mentioned, you know, what gets taught about American history. I also wonder, Emily, if it matters who is telling it, right? I think To Kill a Mockingbird, written by Harper Lee, published in 1960. It's been on middle school reading lists for decades. I don't know if that's still challenged frequently or ever, but it deals with issues of race, obviously written by a white person. But there are other books dealing with issues of race. We heard Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye came up earlier, that was banned by a school district in Missouri. You know, what do you think is, do you see a connection there, that, you know, the perspective of readers and the perspective of writers that's motivating the, you know, the call for these bans?
Yeah, so we have long had a white heterosexual male as our default protagonist when telling stories. Actually, that's one of the reasons why Harper Lee's book was so popular, because it's told by a young girl, and that made it quite unusual for the age. We are decentering that particular protagonist, and that can be difficult for some people to say, well, we're going to center other voices that aren't usually heard. It doesn't mean that we never hear from those voices. You know, I think it's actually important to hear from other voices. I think Harper Lee and her take on how this looked to a young girl who was describing her life, which is what Harper Lee saw when she was growing up, is actually also important, because that's how you respond to the Jim Crow laws, white supremacy. But we also want to hear from the other side, from perhaps the children of the man who was in the court.
Yeah. Kelly, let me ask you, I understand Moms for Liberty is a group that seems to be mobilizing around getting books removed. We heard a clip from a school board meeting in Illinois last fall, a little earlier in the program. Can you tell us about this group and if they're behind a lot of this?
They are, and they're not the only ones. There are a few other groups as well. There's No Left Turn is one that comes to mind. And then in Illinois, we have a couple as well. Awake Illinois is one of those groups. And these groups seem to be following some similar patterns. They're founded by folks who ran for school board last year, didn't get elected, created these groups. These are well-funded, well-connected groups with right-wing politicians. And so they're using their money and their power to build these tremendous networks. Moms for Liberty, for example, is operating county by county so that they can push their agendas quickly. Critical race theory stemmed from that, the anti-critical race theory, like, big movement we had earlier this fall. They were really behind that push. And their actions are allowing more local groups to do the same thing. They're following similar playbooks. And when you start to look at where the money is and where the money's coming from in these groups, it's not just politicians, but they're getting money from groups like the Heritage Foundation, which have connections to homeschooling, to religious schooling. And so when you start to pick through these groups and you look at what they're doing, you see the straight line from why they are creating havoc in public schools, why they're using books as their target right now, and then the agendas that they're pushing to have their kids in homeschool curriculums or in these private parochial education systems. Awake Illinois, for example, has one that they're really pushing to parents. And so it's this it ties into exactly what both Emily and Brett were talking about, the decreased intellectualization in the classroom, to wanting to continue to pursue this white supremacist history. Because if they have their own schools, they can teach these white God-centric curriculums that don't allow any other voices to be the ones that are heard in the room.
Interesting. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. We just heard there from Kelly Jensen of Book Riot, who tracks challenges to books. We're also speaking with Emily Knox, who's in the School of Information Sciences at U of I Urbana and is the author of Book Banning in 21st Century America, and Brett Kaplan, who is director of the Initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies and a professor at U of I Urbana, about challenges to books. Brett, I want to ask you what you think, and maybe this is a little speculative now, but you know, I saw a tweet responding to, I think this was what happened in Tennessee, and said, you know, when you look back at history, people who were in favor of, you know, banning books or censoring books are rarely the victors, maybe never the victors, or, you know, the people who come out looking good in history. What do you think is the end game here?
Oh, that's such a good question, and I'm so glad that you asked it, and it picks up on something that Emily just said, and then that Kelly also brought up, which is this whole idea of the majority and minority positions as we imagine them flipping over, right? And in my most hopeful moments, I like to see all of these attempts at this reinvigoration of white supremacy as the kind of dying breath of a dying dragon, right? That white supremacists know that no longer will America be majority white. And to them, that is deeply, deeply, deeply threatening. So I like to see all of these attacks on our voting rights, on our ability to read complex literature. And just for the record, I think, and this is not an uninformed view, that Toni Morrison is simply the best American writer of the 20th and early 21st centuries, right? To ban her, to get rid of that incredibly powerful voice, it all feels to me like people under threat behave this way, right? And what we're experiencing is actually a different kind of minority rule in the sense that the majority of Americans, when you do polls, believe in something like a multiracial democracy, believe that people of all genders and all races and all beliefs have the right to exist unharassed and to express themselves in whatever way. That's the majority view. And yet we consistently are confronted with minority rule. And so I think, I mean, Emily, it's so important when you say that this is a threat, right? So the end game, I think, is to maintain white supremacy. But like I said, in my hopeful moments, I like to see this as the dying gasp. I hope I'm right. You know, I mean, it's very difficult to be a witness to what is happening right now. And Emily, I also think it's really important that you bring up how do teachers teach the insurrection and what is going on in terms of trying to make that into, what did they say, a peaceful protest? It clearly wasn't. They broke into the Capitol. It was a violent attempt to overthrow democracy. And I think all we can do is really try to bolster democracy, get everyone who can vote to vote. You know?
Yeah. Legitimate political discourse, I think, was the phrase that the party adopted. Emily, one other thing I'm curious about with this. You've written about the reading practices of people who challenge these books. And I think we got a little taste of that with that excerpt I read from the minutes of that Tennessee school board meeting. Can you talk about how reading practices factor into some of these challenges?
That's actually how I got interested in looking at book challenges in the first place. I love thinking about reading and why books are important and why people love books, actually. I say that as someone who teaches in our Library and Information Science program. And when I talk about reading practices, what I actually mean is, how do we interpret text? And what about our own baggage leads us to interpret texts in certain ways? when people challenge books just in general, it's more that we can see why books matter, why reading is fundamental. So I always talk about after the George Floyd murder, what happened? All of a sudden, book lists everywhere. You can even name the books that showed up so quickly that everybody suddenly had to read. That's not a mistake. In our society, in the global north, let's call it, reading is incredibly important. And actually, this reifies the book itself, because books are supposed to contain truth, capital T, truth. And so when someone encounters books that don't contain the truth, it becomes very uncomfortable. So it's really a way of thinking about how do we circulate knowledge in our world? How do we understand the process of education? When I talk to people, when I did interviews with challengers, they would say things like, I can't understand why someone would put this trash in a book, right? Why would they write this trash? And then why would the publishers publish it? Because the book itself is seen as such a, I'm just going to say, a sacred object. And if you doubt me on that, ask yourself, do you break the spines of your books? That's how I always start with my students, asking them that. And then I ask them, what if I just put this book on the floor and walked on it? People do not do that.
My skin is crawling. My skin is crawling.
And there's a reason. And so that's really what I think about with this. And I'm hoping to explore more about images. Graphic novels themselves are in this very liminal space. They're basically a new genre, although new is relative, of thinking about how images and text work together. They are not children's picture books. They are not the same as basic textual literary fiction. They work differently. And we are still grappling with that. And if you're curious as to how that works, if you go to the local public library, ask where the graphic novels are. They are in many different places in the library. Indeed. And that's not surprising. This is a new way of a form of the book, but it's still wrapped in this codex, this incredible technology that was developed thousands of years ago. And just thinking about it, you can see why books matter.
Absolutely. Well, and because they do matter, and because I suspect this is not the last we will hear of attempts to challenge books, I'm sure this conversation will continue another time, but we're going to have to leave it there for today. I want to thank Emily Knox, Brett Kaplan, and Kelly Jensen for being with us today, talking about this important subject here on the 21st. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Coming up, we'll hear from your favorite neighborhood historian, Sherman Dilla Thomas of Chicago. He makes history videos on TikTok that have gained him tens of thousands of followers. He is TikTok famous. It's a great conversation. Because today's show is on tape, also, I should mention, we're not taking calls during our program, but we always do love hearing what you thought about what we talked about here on the 21st Show. Send us an email. The address is talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. We love feedback, constructive criticism, suggestions for future topics and guests. We just love hearing from you. We can't respond necessarily to every email we get, but we do read them all. Again, talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. Sherman Dilla Thomas coming up. Stay with us.